Good afternoon. I'm Judge Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Bartley to my right and Judge Lauer to my left. We are convened today to consider the arguments in the matter of Carlton H. Ingram versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 23-1798. Will counsel, beginning with appellate's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
Yes, Your Honor. Louis George with the National Veterans Legal Services Program representing Mr. Ingram. And with me at counsel's table is co-counsel C. Jeffrey Price.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Andrew Countryman, and with me at counsel's table is Mark Bichich on behalf of the government.
Will you be requesting time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We're reserving 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Okay, counsel, if you're ready, you may begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Mr. Ingram suffers from service-connected back and left ankle disabilities that are alleviated by medication. Mr. Ingram testified at his BVA hearing that he takes pain medication daily, and that it alleviates his pain, or in his own words, that it kind of eases both his back and ankle pain. The Secretary concedes that the applicable diagnostic codes do not contemplate the ameliorative effects of medication, and that the effects must be discounted when assigning a rating, following this court's precedent in Jones and McCarroll. Despite these concessions, his position is that the board's silence is golden. That is, if the board avoids discussing medication, as it did in this case, the decision complies with Jones. The court has consistently rejected this argument, irrespective of the diagnostic codes at issue. But turning to the court has asked us today to discuss the interplay between Jones and 38 CFR 4.40 and related case law. Section 4.40 and Jones are complementary and should be read in tandem. We are asking the court to require the VA to follow Jones when evaluating musculoskeletal disabilities under 38 CFR section 4.71A, and to reject their litigation position to carve out an exception for cases that are evaluated based on limitation of motion. Now, turning first to section 4.40 and the law surrounding it, including this court's decision in 2017 in Sharp v. Shulkin, which the court referenced in its clarification order. And the court addressed in Sharp, as well as 4.40, it really addresses what information must be gathered when evaluating functional loss when rating musculoskeletal disabilities. But this authority doesn't instruct how to apply the information to the diagnostic criteria. And so that's where Jones comes in. And Jones, and as later affirmed by this court in the en banc decision in McCarroll, provides instruction as to what to do in terms of when medication is taken, specifically involving a diagnostic code that does not explicitly contemplate the ameliorative effects of medication. And in those cases, the board must discount those ameliorative effects. Now, the holding in Jones, it's a two-prong holding, and it's based on this court's 1994 decision in Massey v. Brown, which prohibits the board from considering factors outside of the rating criteria when evaluating a disability. And a second prong involves the secretary's deliberate choice. That is, when the secretary has explicitly considers medication in one diagnostic criteria, but excludes it from others. And so by doing, the secretary has made a deliberate choice not to include consideration of those medications. And in particular, the court in Jones even referenced diagnostic criteria, for example, related to fibromyalgia, which is a diagnostic code 5025, or bronchial asthma, which is at 6602, which do contemplate the ameliorative effects of medication. But importantly, in turning to what the court was interested in addressing, 4.40 and sort of the broad canvas as noted in the, by the Federal Circuit in the Thompson case. 4.40 itself doesn't explicitly contemplate the ameliorative effects of medication. And so what the Secretary would like the court to do is to read out this deliberate choice, arguing that 4.40 and Jones are duplicative, rather than complementary, and really asks him to take him at his word that he's already ensuring that the ameliorative effects of medication are not considered during a flare-up, because he maintains that the range of motion measurements here are worst case and that they're exclusive of any ameliorative effects. Although the Secretary asks us to take him at his word here, we just don't know, and neither does the board, because the examiner here didn't spell it out. The Secretary cites to no policy nor guidance that would instruct VA examiners when offering opinions as to range of motion to do so under the worst case scenario, absent the effects of medication. And that's sort of the important factor here. Although the court in Sharp noted the VA clinician's guide, which now also comes to play in like the DBQs, which you'll see in, for example, even in this case, the clinician's guide made clear that examiners evaluating certain musculoskeletal conditions need to take into consideration certain things. They need to take into account, for example, alleviating effects, frequency, duration, precipitating effects, and the effects of functional impairment. However, though, there's no reference in the guide to discounting the ameliorative effects of medication.
Counsel, are you arguing that you can be on medications and still have these flare-ups?
Yes, Your Honor. You can be on medications and still certainly have flare-ups.
And does the record here demonstrate that Mr. Ingram was on meds when he had flares?
The record reflects, Your Honor, that the veteran was on medication and on a daily basis, and at he stated at his hearing that he was on medication on a daily basis. And at record site 320, which is in January of 2020, he indicated that the pain is always there. So in terms of and also the record reflects as well that when he at the most recent exam in 2022, he indicated with respect to his left ankle condition that I believe that he was that he would have flare-ups and that it would be like an hour and a half until the medication kicks in. But there's no indication that the medication has alleviated his pain in terms of that it's eliminated it completely, Your Honor. Uh-huh. And so looking at the worst case scenario as well, it doesn't contemplate, for example, that a veteran who has a flare-up, and if you're even using an example of from a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, a veteran who is not on medication may be at a 10, whereas the veteran might be at an 8 while they're on medication. And so that's why under Jones, really the board and also the examiner needs to address the effects of that medication. And just in the same way as the court instructed in Sharp that the examiner can obtain information, such as even asking information from the from the veteran, asking questions or reviewing lay statements from the veteran, they can make a determination as to the effects of the medication. And
so the Secretary cites Mitchell and says a functional loss caused by pain must be rated at the same level as if that functional loss were caused by some other factor that actually limited motion. So he seems to be saying that whenever you're on meds, your range of motion isn't actually limited. What's your response to that? So why would you be compensated, in other words?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, because even while you're on, while veterans on medication, they would still be and for Mr. Ingram's case, it was noted in both the examination reports that he was taking medication. Was that I believe that it was noted in the report that he was taking, I believe, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and other medication is referenced in the record as well. And so there is, in terms of the effects of that, the fact that a certain limitation of motion may be shown with medication, we just don't know because there's been no discounting, there's been no eliciting by the examiner of the effects of medication, we don't know if it would be worse but for the medication. And so that's why we argue that in terms of complying with Jones, both the board as well as the examiner, because the board does rely on the examination reports, needs to address these ameliorative effects and address what would the level of pain be but for the medication. And also with respect to flare-ups too, a worst-case scenario as well might not even necessarily involve flare-ups. You could have a veteran who's suffering from a level but constant level of pain that is ameliorated by medication. And the Secretary's argument here appears to read Jones out of that equation as well. And here, the veteran did, at his June 2022 exam, which is the most recent examination, both his back and his left ankle disability were evaluated at that time. And under the Secretary's interpretation, this would be the worst-case scenario, without the ameliorative effects of medication. Yet the Secretary did concede that during the same rating period, this is a lengthy rating period, that there was evidence that the veteran had worse range of motion, that there was even there were physical therapy records which showed that he had range of motion of 25% of the normal range of motion. And that's a grounds for a concession of remand as it relates to the back disability. But how can then that the examination in 2022 be the worst case if there's other record evidence showing that it's even worse? And so that's why it was incumbent upon the board to follow Jones and to be able to address the ameliorative effects of medication, which it didn't do, and also that the examiner didn't do so as well. And so looking at the Secretary's position, it really appears to be more of a convenient litigating position in this case. Now, turning also to Jones, and again, coming back to Jones and the factors in Jones, as it relates to the deliberate choice by the Secretary does know how to explicitly incorporate the ameliorative effects of medication in the regulatory criteria. For example, as recently as 2022, when the VA proposed amendments to its mental health rating criteria in the supplemental information of the final rule, the VA expressly cited Jones as well as McCarroll, and in the rating criteria itself addresses the ameliorative effects of medication and indicates that in evaluating mental health disability that the ameliorative effects are taken into account. So the Secretary is aware of and knows how to do that. And similarly, when the Secretary, as recently as the fall of 2020, revised the rating criteria for musculoskeletal disabilities, that was effective in February of 2021. And the Secretary did not add language with respect to the ameliorative effects of medication, didn't address that at all. And interestingly, the Secretary, in that same revision, which was not an insignificant revision, the Secretary revised the criteria for instability of the knee under Diagnostic Code 5257. And the Secretary referenced prescribed use of a brace, a cane, or a walker, yet made no reference to the ameliorative effects of medication. So it cannot be said that the Secretary was unaware of the law that existed for nearly a decade before proceeding to these changes. And what we would say is if indeed the Secretary is already discounting the ameliorative effects of medication, then he must do so explicitly so that appellants such as Mr. Ingram, as well as the court, can follow along. The board, and for the same reason VA examiners, really need to show their work, for lack of a better term. Now, the Secretary also has told us, too, that despite the fact that the VA is already evaluating musculoskeletal disabilities under this worst-case scenario, excluding any ameliorative effects of medication, well, he then makes another argument. He says that to do so, it would be impossible because it would invite speculation. Now, there's an inconsistency to this argument. I mean, the secretary did not present it as an alternative argument, but it was an additional argument to their saying, well, it already considers the worst case. Then the secretary indicated, well, it's speculative. And this really calls into question their argument that they're already doing it. But then the speculation point can be answered by what this court has said in its case law. For example, in Sharp, the court did address in terms of there are times that an examiner, especially in Sharp, you're looking at the addressing functional loss, needs to make these could be tough decisions in terms of addressing what are the ameliorative effects of, rather for Sharp, it's dealing with functional loss. But here, an examiner could certainly address the ameliorative effects of medication, as the board could. And
Mr. George, are you talking about things like evidence from the record, the medical records, as well as soliciting information from the veteran during the course of the exam? Is that the same types of things under Sharp?
Yes, Your Honor.
That you would use to determine the ameliorative effects would be for the medication?
Yes, Your Honor. In the very same way that an examiner could elicit that information, could be citations to the record, could be asking questions of the veteran in terms of, well, before you took, for example, before you started taking medication, how was it? How is, how long does the medication last? What's your functional, effects of them, both with medication and without? So those sort of things can be certainly addressed. And the Federal Circuit in the Spicer case addressed even this similar speculation argument. Now, Spicer involved a different issue dealing with secondary service connection, dealing with aggravation. However, though, when confronted with a similar speculation argument from VA, the court indicated that, cited Jones and McCarroll for the proposition that VA is suited to make these sort of calls, and even cited, independent of Jones and McCarroll, cited what the secretary needs to do in 1151 claims. So a claim for additional disability due to VA medical care under 1151. That those sort of medical opinion questions, that's something that's within the VA's wheelhouse. Now, finally, the secretary tells us too that despite that they're already doing the worst case scenario, but then the additional argument, the inconsistent argument, which we point out that it's too speculative. The secretary also pointed out that they're prohibited from rating disabilities absent the ameliorative effects of medication, because to do so the veteran doesn't actually experience that level of impairment. Now, there's a false premise to this argument, that assumes a level of impairment absent medication, that it's always hypothetical. And put another way, it always assumes that the veteran, when they're under treatment for medication, suffers, never has impairments with the medication. And that's not the case here. I mean, the veteran due to medication is just that, it's alleviating. It doesn't mean that it eliminates it. And the veteran complained, as I mentioned earlier, that in January 2020, record site 320, he complained that the pain is always there. And it's also inconsistent with the rating schedule as well, where VA may assign a compensable rating where symptoms are controlled by medication. So, for example, fibromyalgia provides for, when there's continuous medication under 5025, you can have a compensable rating. Similarly, for mental health conditions, under the current diagnostic criteria, a veteran can have a 10% rating if the symptoms are controlled by medication. And similarly, even under the proposed regulations for mental disorders, there is a minimum 10% rating. So coming back to Jones here, Jones really does, provides the answer here. It's based in sound case law, going back to the court's Massey decision in 1994, that we're looking at the ability of the VA to rate a disability based on factors outside of the rating schedule. And then again, the VA's deliberate choice not to include in some rating criteria ameliorative effects, in others not. And as we pointed out earlier, the VA has done this in their as recently as 2022, in the mental health criteria, they've expressly incorporated the ameliorative effects of medication. They cite Jones and McCarroll, straightforwardly in the supplemental information. And more tellingly, in the revision of the lumbosacral, in the revision of the musculoskeletal criteria, effective in 2021, they didn't do that. They didn't go and reference the, they made no reference to the ameliorative effects of medication. So again, because of Jones, because of the two-prong underpinnings of Jones, that the board may not consider factors outside of the diagnostic criteria when rating a disability, and that the secretary made a deliberate choice to not to include the effects of medication in some criteria and to include it in others, the court should reject the secretary's litigation position. It should vacate and remand the board's decision for the reasons addressed today, as well as for the reasons described in the initial and in our reply briefs. And should your honors have any further questions?
Mr. George, is there anything comparable in the rating schedule to the musculoskeletal diagnostic code's requirement to consider flares? Like this is the basis for the secretary's argument that there are these worst case scenarios called flares, and that they're already obligated to do what you're saying that should be done, should have been done here. And so is there any other diagnostic code that would, or section like digestive or whatever, that requires that kind of that would provide the basis for the secretary to go further and say, oh yeah, that would apply in these other three situations as well as musculoskeletal?
Well, in terms of flares themselves, I'm not familiar. And Your Honor, I'm actually going into my...
Yeah, I just alerted the clerk to give you five more minutes.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. So in terms of this, in terms of coming to mind, I mean, the diagnostic criteria certainly cover, worsening conditions as you go up the, as you go from 10, 20, 30, et cetera. In terms of flare-ups per se, I'm not familiar with any with additional with other rating criteria. I mean, some that come to mind, for example, I think could be, for example, in terms of headaches in which you're in which the rating is based upon prostrating attacks, and so the more attacks one has because of headaches, then you can receive a higher rating up to a maximum of 50%. And headaches also is a criteria which doesn't include there's not a reference to ameliorative effects of medication. So Jones certainly could be applicable to that setting. So.
Thank you. I just wanted a clarification.
Yes,
Where a diagnostic code does not refer to any kind of medication, is it that when the record reflects that the veteran is taking medication, that the board has to address the medication and then discount its effects? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yes, Your Honor. It's related to it's not just necessarily taking medication, but they have ameliorative effects of medication. So a veteran is taking medication, and that medication is, and I think as Jones and McCarroll talk about in terms of the ameliorating effects of that medication, so the beneficial effects of the medication.
And in every case that has a medication indication that medication is being taken, mm-hmm. that they have to address the effects and then discount them.
If the veteran is taking medication and the veteran is receiving ameliorative effects from the medication, then Jones tells us that the board may not deny the claim based upon the evidence that includes the ameliorative effects of medication without discounting it, without taking it out. Because again, it comes back to the Massey v. Brown case where the board may not rate a claim, may not consider factors outside of the rating criteria. So otherwise, without discounting it, they would be considering these effects, and those are not set forth in the rating schedule. And the VA certainly could have done that. I mean, that was one of the factors in Jones, in that this is something that the secretary, it's a deliberate choice that they have the ability through notice and comment rulemaking to include the ameliorative effects of medication in the rating criteria, or they may not. And so that's a deliberate choice, and they didn't do so in this case. And the secretary acknowledged Jones and McCarroll in their briefing, as well as acknowledged that the diagnostic codes at issue did not take into account the ameliorative effects of medication. So this is not a case similar to where there's a discussion about whether or not the rating criteria consider the ameliorative effects. Of course, I understand the point that we were discussing today about 4.40 and related cases. But as we point out, however, though, in the facts of with respect to this case, the court should reject the secretary's argument to essentially create a carve out of Jones for musculoskeletal conditions that are evaluated based on limitation of motion.
Mr. George, are you asking the court to make a blanket rule here that the examiners have to provide separate range of motion estimates when they're examining veterans who take medication to determine like the baseline severity of their condition, like in SHARP, mm-hmm. or are you saying this should be a case-by-case determination for the adjudicator to decide whether there's additional medical evidence required?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's certainly a consideration in terms of Jones. Jones calls for what the board needs to do, what the raters need to do, and that is informed by the medical evidence. And so, similar to a situation in which involving functional loss due to pain, you might have a situation where you certainly could have a situation. I notice I'm over my time. Can I?
Okay. Two more minutes.
Thank you. So you could certainly imagine a situation in which the evidence is already there. There's a sufficient amount of lay evidence. There's a sufficient amount of medical evidence already of record, and so that the board may be able to make that determination based on the evidence it has. However, though, if the medical evidence is lacking, then the board may not make that call without resorting to its own unsubstantiated medical opinion. And yes, it does need to, the examiner does need to go and do that additional step, do that homework. And what we argued here is based on the facts of this case, the examiner did need to do that. There was evidence in the record that the veteran was taking medication and that the examiner needed to undertake that additional questioning. So coming back to your question, in terms of asking for a blanket, rule, I would stop short of asking for a blanket rule in terms of examinations need to do that in each and every one of the cases. However, though, only because Jones is binding on the board, but nonetheless, I think that that an examination, the need for the examination to address that is going to be, I think, warranted in a number of cases, if otherwise the board doesn't have the information needed to make its decision.
Thank you.
So anywhere where there's evidence that the veteran is taking medications and during the period of flares, mm-hmm. Or during the relevant period, I guess, at all, then your argument would be that the examiner would have to address this.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, for example, here you had analgesics, you had anti-inflammatory. I believe the record also talked about one episode where there were muscle relaxers as well. Mm-hmm. So those are things that, in the appellant's opinion, should have been followed up on by the examiner and considered by the board for fact-finding purposes.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
three minutes. I'll give you three more minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. The exam that should have been addressed by the examiner, and yes, it should have been addressed by the board. And the board in this case was silent in terms of the there's nothing in the board decision in terms of in their analysis addressing the medication or discounting the ameliorative effects of medication. So as a result, we don't, you know, the appellant, Mr. Ingram, as well as the court, doesn't know in terms of whether or not the board indeed was complying with Jones. And again, as we pointed out, we're asking that the board show its work and be able to show that the ameliorative effects of medication were properly discounted. Thank you. Does Your Honor have any further questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Peach, Your Honors, may it please the court. The court should affirm the board's decision for three reasons. First, the board had before it all of the information it needed to ensure that the veteran's back and ankle disabilities were properly rated. Second, the board here cited to Jones, making clear that it knew of the prohibition against denying entitlement to a higher rating on the basis of relief provided by medication. And third, DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp already require adjudicators to consider the aspect of the disability that appellant says is being overlooked. First, the evidence presented to the board was a full picture of the veteran's ankle and back disabilities. July 2022 VA examiner opined on the frequency, severity, duration, alleviating, and precipitating factors related to the veteran's flares. The examiner noted that the ankle flares were moderate to severe, lasted 3 to 4 times a week. 1 to 2 hours is how long they lasted until medication kicked in. Precipitating factors were walking, twisting, laying down with his feet hanging, and the alleviating factors were pain medication and cold compression. The back, the same examiner said that the veteran's flares were severe, lasted 15 days a month, on each occasion they would last all day. Precipitating factors were sitting too long, standing too long, twisting his body, and laying flat in his bed. The alleviating factors were pain medication, elevating his legs, rest, electric stim, and a lumbar extension device. After describing...
So, Mr. Countryman, I'll ask you the same question that I asked appellant's counsel, and that is, so a veteran could be, this is just a general question, but it applies to Mr. Ingram as well, a veteran can be on medication and still have flare-ups. Is that you agree with that?
Those are not the facts before us, and I don't think the court needs to answer that question to resolve this case. I think the facts that we have before us are that the veteran reported taking medication to alleviate his flare-ups.
And so, do we have evidence that there was complete alleviation? I mean, as we know, alleviate doesn't mean cure. It might mean make a little bit better, but it's still pretty darn bad.
Correct. I don't know that we have any evidence in this case that the veteran took medication that fully resolved the pain. Again, though, I don't think that the court needs to even answer that question, though. And I would jump to the court's cases in DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp, which do already ask the question of what a veteran's good days are and what the veteran's bad days are. That language comes from DeLuca. And to ask the question of whether the veteran's bad days might be worse but for his use of medication necessarily answers the question of what his hypothetical disability might be. And that's that the secretary wishes to make today is that it cannot be a hypothetical disability that the veteran is receiving compensation for. So I know it came up in the earlier, but our position is yes, that DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp already compensate for the extent of the full picture of the veteran's disability. So there's no no need to go into the question of what the disability might look like if the veteran took more medication, if the medication that he does take were stronger or some other type of medication, what level of relief he receives from that medication. Our position, and to bring it back to Jones, is that those questions are off limits from the board's analysis. I would also make the point that my colleague on the other side.
Why are those questions off limits?
Well, because the emphasis, my understanding, is largely on the court's decision in McCarroll, right, which is the first opinion that we see the word discount used. That word does not appear in the Jones decision. And I would argue that the appellant has all but conceded that McCarroll is dicta as it relates to how Jones applies. As you all would likely note, the secretary raised the argument in briefing that Jackson essentially says as much about Jones as McCarroll did. The similarity between Jackson and McCarroll are that both of those cases involve a scenario where the diagnostic code at issue does not mention medication. And in the appellant's reply brief, the response was that Jackson is dicta as it relates to Jones. So,
well, could a panel decision like Jackson completely erode the conclusions in Jones? I mean, isn't that counter to our, wouldn't we have to go en banc to completely erode Jones?
Correct. That's not the point that I wish to make. I would agree that anything that Jones, or rather McCarroll, says as the en banc court, as far as Jones goes, does carry weight. I would not argue that it doesn't, but the key language was when the court was deciding that preliminary or threshold question about whether the diagnostic code at issue contemplated medication or not, and then found that it did, the court said that Jones was inapplicable. And our argument today is that that has to mean something, that anything else beyond that case being inapplicable is unnecessary to resolve that case. So, again, though, I want to make sure that it's not lost that if Jackson and anything Jackson says about Jones is dicta, then that necessarily means that anything that McCarroll says about Jones is also dicta. And the appellant made that same argument in his reply brief.
Well, I mean, Jackson was more about, first of all, it involved diabetes, of course, and it was more about cabining in the right. Obviously, it was a diagnostic code that looked at medications being involved, and it was about finding the right place, the right percentage for purposes of the disability. And so it was a matter of looking. I don't understand the impact that would have on Jones that you're describing at all, because to me, and we've obviously had several non-presidential single judge memoranda since then that have considered Jackson without and leaving its holding unaddressed, basically, or not unaddressed, but working it in to make the same considerations that the court did under Jones, simply looking at the codes to decide whether it considers medication or it doesn't. And so Jackson obviously involved medication as part of the rating schedule to figure out. Am I missing something?
No, I think that's our point, Your Honor, that just like McCarroll dealt with a diagnostic code that did contemplate medication, in that case it was hypertension, of course, Jackson also contemplated a diagnostic code that included medication. So the applicability of Jackson and McCarroll on Jones, our argument is that neither of those cases, we're happy to agree with the appellant's counsel that neither of those cases shed any light on how Jones must apply. Again, I believe that comes back to the to one, the word in McCarroll, inapplicable. We argue that means that anything that court said in that case about Jones and how it applies necessarily is dicta, because it's not necessary to resolve that case. But turning back to the plain language, I suppose you would say, of Jones, our reading of that case is that we would agree the board is prohibited from denying entitlement to a higher rating on the basis of relief provided by medication. And in the facts before us here, we don't have open questions as to what medication might be. Sure, I suppose there could be questions like, what if you were taking a different type of medication? But that's, of course, not a question that needs to be resolved. The July 2022 VA examination fully complied with this court's case law, DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp, and answered the question of what the worst-case scenario is of the veteran's disability. And I would like to clarify the point of the board needing to rate based on exclusively the worst-case scenario. That's not entirely – we would argue that the board must consider that certainly as a factor, but the board also needs to consider the best days that the veteran has as well. It's not an exercise where you look at, he has a spike on this day or that day. There's a general disability picture that needs to be developed and presented to the board, and then the board and its adjudicatory authority then needs to rate that disability as it's presented.
I'll just say that sounds completely counter to what I usually see in decisions and what I think is the proper way to evaluate conditions. Because it sounds like you're saying ignore the veteran's flare-ups and, weigh it with how many good days he or she might have with how many bad days or whatever. But, I mean, generally, I think the way the board does it, which I think is compliant with case law and regulation, is that the doctor might, if the veteran's not there on a flare day, would elicit some information about how bad it gets, and then the board will actually apply the diagnostic criteria to account for the how bad it actually gets for the veteran.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I disagree with that.
Oh, I thought you said that you don't.
Yeah.
You don't evaluate based on the veteran's flare-ups. And
oh,
generally, you do.
Sorry. Yeah. If that is what I communicated, that I apologize. No, we would agree.
Well, that was actually what you said.
Yeah. If that's what I said, then I apologize. My point is simply that DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp do inquire into that. The board is required to obtain information about the veteran's worst case scenario, call it his bad days, the extent of the disability that he experiences. Our point or our emphasis today is that beyond that, asking the question of what this disability might be but for the use of medication necessarily goes into a hypothetical world that may or may not come to pass. And so to ground or to require the board to compensate for that level of hypothetical disability is contrary to actually the regulation that DeLuca and expounded on and Mitchell and Sharp, 4.40. It is functional loss that should be the chief aim of the examiners and the board. And our position today is simply that DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp already gather that information and provide that to an adjudicator. I would also like to emphasize that agreeing with the other side's version of this rule leads to a presumption of error. If the rule is that when a diagnostic code does not contemplate medication, and a veteran presents with evidence, or there is evidence in the record that the veteran does use medication, then the board is required to affirmatively or explicitly discount the ameliorative effects thereof. What that effectively is a presumption of error on the part of the board, and I'm currently unaware of any other area of veterans law that presumes that the board errs unless it explicitly says that it hasn't. Right? If we think a much more straightforward reading of this rule is simply that the board is, like Jones says, prohibited from considering the effects of medication unless the diagnostic code contemplates them. If there are no further questions, we would make sure to emphasize that on the facts of the case before the court today, we're not asking for the court to break any new ground as it relates to Jones. We're simply asking the court to take note of the fact that the board was presented with a full picture of the veteran's disability and rated it properly, and it did not violate Jones in so doing.
If the court were to say that in cases where the diagnostic code does not address medication, and therefore there's nothing to discount. But what if we were to say that any time there's medication, any evidence of medication, you would have to affirmatively recognize that and then discount that? How would that affect, what effect would that have on the VA in terms of implementation?
Well, I would say again that would effectively introduce a rule that is a presumption of error. So it sounds to me like, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, you're asking whether if the agency would then be required to ask a question to each veteran on a DBQ or in an exam, how that would impact the agency?
Well, I would think that just about every claimant would be taking medication of some sort, otherwise they wouldn't really maybe be there. So it would mean that most of them are taking medication. So how would that result in the workload and the effect on what needed to be done by VA officials, including the board?
I would imagine. I think it would be beyond sort of the facts that we have before us, but I would be, I think, safe to speculate that it would create an additional burden. I think it would not be insignificant. I think that asking that question does delve into issues that this court has addressed when it comes to speculative opinions. The board then would be forced to send back for additional development in any case when, again, a diagnostic code doesn't mention medication, but a veteran presents with evidence that he has taken medication ever. I would imagine likely lead to some of the issues that we see in cases like DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp, where examiners are hesitant to speculate on what a disability might be in some other context. I think that the distinction, though, what we have here versus what is going on in DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp is that the aim of those cases is still getting at an actual disability that the veteran experiences. We think to ask the question, what would the disability be like in some other context? That's not what Sharp was doing. That's not in Sharp. The veteran presented to the examination room and said, I'm not experiencing a flare right now, but I do experience flare-ups, and the court and the secretary's position in that case was that know, that might be too speculative to require examiners to, you know, opine on what the flare-up might be in some other location. But ultimately, that case still, at its core, achieves the goal of gathering the information about what the actual disability that the veteran experienced is. Whereas in this case, asking the question of what the disability might be but for medication use is a fundamentally different question and necessarily goes into a different, it goes beyond actual disability and into hypothetical disability in our view.
Well, couldn't someone have said the same thing about Sharp? I mean, you're the doctor in Sharp, and in Sharp-like cases is required to assess if the veteran comes in, is not experiencing a flare at that time, and the doctor elicits information about what happens during the flare and what kind of range of motion problems the veteran has, et cetera. And then the doctor gives an opinion and the adjudicator makes a decision about what the veteran's condition is like during the flare. How disabling is it? And so how would this be any different from that? I mean, you keep saying it's not an actual, and I think I asked appellant's counsel, because you're saying it's like it's not an actual disability.
That is our view, Your Honor, that asking the question of what the disability might be but for the use of medication is asking a question that is untethered to reality, to the actual disability that the veteran experiences. With flare-ups, our view of Sharp or reading of Sharp is that an examiner asking that question, the examiner is still asking the veteran to tell the examiner how bad are your bad days?
This might not be exactly like that situation, and that maybe you don't pay attention only to what the veteran says about what it's like when he or she doesn't take the medication. I mean, in this situation, he was taking opioids. And so I would think a doctor would be able to say, without that opioid, the veteran would be such and such disabled, this level of severity. I mean, how is that different from the kind of investigation that Sharp requires in order to do justice to veterans?
I think, again, the difference is that with Sharp and asking the veteran the question of what his disability is and requiring the examiner to opine on what the additional loss of range of motion might be, outside of the examination room. Outside of the examination room still occurs. That is still that is still functional loss that the veteran is experiencing. Whereas in this case, asking an examiner to opine on, it's sort of a layer, right? Is what it sounds like you're offering is a layer on too Sharp to require the examiner to say, what is the flare outside of the examination room or in, but what would that flare be like but for the use of medication? That again is the emphasis of our reading of what is not required by Luca Mitchell and Sharp and is actually prohibited by the Secretary's regulations 4.40, 1110, the statutes as well.
Well, that's why we're here, right? Like, we don't have a case that actually addresses whether the carve-out you're trying to create would be in compliance with the VA evaluation system. So we're here to look at that.
Yeah, and I would, on that point, I would point the court to the July 2022 VA examination where the veteran was asked what precipitating and alleviating factors related to his flare-ups. The veteran reported not that he took medication every day. He said that I experienced flare-ups, and I mentioned the duration and severity of them at the top, but he said that medication is what alleviates those disabilities. So our view of the facts of this case is that is, at minimum, a plausible provided a plausible basis for the board to conclude that it had before it the full extent of the veteran's disability picture.
Well, I don't want to really argue with you, but you keep making these arguments that I find flawed. So I just looked up alleviate with my handy phone here, and it says make less severe. So it doesn't, you seem to be implying that alleviate means to just, it got rid of it. But it does, I mean, it could have gotten rid of it, the opioid or the drug that he was taking, the muscle relaxant, but not necessarily. I mean, it might have just taken the edge off of it. As a matter of fact, I think there is a record in Mr. Ingram's case that where he talks about it takes the edge off.
I suppose if the, the point is that taking medication only sometimes alleviates the disability, that would still be the occasion when medication did not alleviate the disability would still be found in that examination report. That would be when the veteran experiences a flare-up, right? If the veteran says, I experience flare-ups, medication sometimes alleviates my disability, and the point of DeLuca, Mitchell, and Jones, or Sharp were to make sure that the full extent, or rather the bad days, right, the flare-ups of the disability is put before the board, then I my response would be that is a different question of, well, what happens if the medication doesn't fully resolve the pain or the disability. The flare-up or the worst day, the worst case, is we already know what that is, at least based on the responses to the questions in the July 2022. report.
The record here, though, shows that in addition to the flare-ups that we've been talking about, that Mr. Ingram also was prescribed daily medication as part of his routine. And so does the examiner who's using the range of motion estimates for the flare-ups have to implicitly exclude the ameliorative impact of medication? You have a number of things here in the record that show both use of medication to alleviate during flare-ups, but then also daily.
I would initially dispute the premise, which is that if he's prescribed a daily medication that that the veteran then takes that medication daily. That, and the reason I would dispute that premise is because of the exam, the July 2022 exam, right? If the veteran is asked, what are your alleviating, precipitating factors related to flare-ups, then the veteran at that point could have, but did not, say, I take daily pain medication to alleviate my disability. That's not what veteran said. The veteran said that I experience flare-ups and I take pain medications, which I believe he said after 1 to 2 hours kick in on one occasion, but ultimately that was the alleviating factor, not a precipitating factor that he responded with.
Where in the record does he
deny
taking daily medications? You mentioned the...
No, I didn't deny. My argument is that there's no affirmative evidence either that he did take daily pain medication.
But he was prescribed.
Right. And so if he's posed with the question, what precipitates your flares and what alleviates them, are... view is that saying that I take pain medication to alleviate the flare-ups, then I suppose our simple view is that that is at least plausible for the board to conclude that that he doesn't take medication daily. But at the end of the day, I don't think that it's a a question that has to be resolved when it comes to what was presented to the board here and the arguments that were raised on the other side. I see that I'm winding down. I thought that was going up, but it's just still going down, so. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, picking up on what the Secretary was was stating with respect to Mr. Ingram's pain medication, the record indeed does reflect that Mr. Ingram was taking pain medication daily. It's at his Board of Veterans Appeals hearing, record site 2417. In addition, he noted at the same hearing that the medication, quote, kind of eases, end quote, his pain, and that's at 2414. So that helps support the proposition that the medication that Mr. Ingram was taking alleviated in that it didn't completely eliminate the pain. And as I noted earlier as well, Mr. Ingram stated that the pain was always there. And this was in the medical record as recently as January of 2020 at record site 320. Now, picking up on sort of on the point about that the in terms of the Secretary's counsel noted that the board had all the evidence before it. And as we pointed out in our brief, we argued that the examination was inadequate because it did fail to address the specifically these ameliorative effects of pain and to discount them out. And picking up on the conversation that was had earlier with respect to DeLuca, Mitchell, and Sharp, and these are the sort of, this is the sort of questions that that a examiner can ask of the veteran. And it's not getting into the range of hypothetical. It's something that, as I believe Judge Bartley had mentioned earlier too, I mean, this is something that the examiners are already doing. And in this particular case, for example, I have a record site at 124, which is the VA examination with respect to Mr. Ingram's back. And at that point in time, even the question was asked, is the veteran experiencing a flare-up at that particular moment? And the answer was no. And so because he wasn't experiencing a flare-up at that moment, the examiner then went forth and under Sharp, Mitchell, and DeLuca, the examiner was able to ascertain functional loss, due to flare-ups. And the examiner did that both for the back as well as for the ankle, showing that there was that limitation of motion was getting, even for example, for the ankle, I believe dorsiflexion was down to 5 degrees. And in this case, to get a higher rating for Mr. Ingram's ankle disability, one needs to be below 5. So it was very much on the cusp in terms of this. So what the examiner didn't do is address these ameliorative effects of medication, didn't ask the questions, which just like asking a question about a flare-up, this is not a hardship on the examiner. The examiner can elicit some further questions from the veteran. With respect to what the board did in this case, and I understand that the board did mention Jones in its recitation of the applicable law in the case, and this is at page 14 of the record. The board noted Jones that, in fact, they cited it inaccurately, by the way. They did say that in Jones, the court held that the board may not deny entitlement to an increased rating on the basis of relief provided by medication when those effects are specifically contemplated by the rating criteria. So the board actually should have indicated that it was not specifically contemplated by the rating criteria. But the mere fact that the board recited this in its recitation, it didn't provide any of the analysis. It didn't provide the analysis that addressed that so that the veteran, Mr. Ingram, and so that the court knows that the court properly, I mean, rather that the board properly applied and understood Jones. And with respect to the question about the whether or not the argument in terms of dicta, whether McCarroll is dicta versus Jones, the Secretary did not argue in their brief that McCarroll was dicta. They said it as an affirmative argument in terms of describing the relevant law in their brief addressing Jones and McCarroll. Now, I understand that they did by citing to Jackson, and they're, you know, they've argued that in our reply brief that by our distinguishing Jackson from the case at hand, that we were conceding that McCarroll is dicta. We were not so doing, and so we were not conceding that McCarroll is dicta. And frankly, McCarroll builds upon Jones, and really coming back to Jones. You know, Jones is the important holding of Jones deals with the board may not rely on factors outside of the rating schedule, going back to Massey, and that the board and that the secretary has made a deliberate choice to include some rating include ameliorative effects of medication in some criteria, and then not in the other. And so the secretary could have, with respect to musculoskeletal conditions, could have incorporated language with respect to the ameliorative effects of medication. They revised the rating criteria as recently as the latter part of 2020, which was probably 8 years after this court issued its decision in Jones. So they were certainly aware of the court's decision in Jones, and they could have done that. So any concerns that they are that they've raised in terms of the burdens on the secretary, that could have been addressed had they desired through notice and comment rulemaking to go and incorporate ameliorative effects of medication, which they chose, their deliberate choice, not to do. And turning as well to the secretary's counsel point about that this would create a presumption of error. And that every time you have a veteran who has, ameliorative effects of, medication, then that they would the board would be, would be required to, to discount it, to discount the effects, and that otherwise the decision would be presumed erroneous. I mean, there are other situations where there's evidence that the board is confronts where the board does need to address it. Where the board does need to, I can think of examples such as when the board is looking at a claim for a total disability rating based on individual unemployability, TDIU, and the board in looking at that decision, I mean, looking at the facts of the case, they may see in the record that the veteran may not be, retired, stopped working because of retirement. But the question that, the binary question that the board needs to evaluate in that case is whether or not the veteran is unemployable because of service-connected disabilities. So the board needs to take away those other factors that don't come into play to the question before it. And here, the question before the board was, looking at the veteran's level of disability for his back condition as well as for his left ankle condition. And under Jones and McCarroll, the board did have an affirmative obligation. Silence is not good enough. The board had an affirmative obligation to discount those ameliorative effects of medication in evaluating his disability. And in this case, the board did not do so. And then turning finally just to the point in terms of the level of impairment that Mr. Ingram suffers from, and again, this is the As I mentioned just at the beginning of my rebuttal, the veteran testified that he takes pain medication daily, and he mentions that it kind of eases the pain, and he also mentioned in medical records that the pain is always there. And even with respect to the most recent VA exam, he indicated, and I believe it was dealing with the ankle disability, with respect to the ankle disability, that he experiences flare-ups that last 1 to 2 hours before the medication kicks in. And that the fact that the medication kicks in doesn't mean that the medication has completely, that the pain has gone down to zero. So the argument here is that, the secretary's argument that we're compensating the veteran for almost a hypothetical, level of functional impairment is an inaccurate premise. It's an inaccurate underlying premise that assumes that the veteran does not have any sort of level of disability, once he's taken medication. The disability is certainly still there. The pain is still there. And so it was incumbent upon the board to, as part of its obligation under Jones and McCarroll, to discount those alleviating effects, those ameliorating effects of medication in evaluating the veteran's disability. So we ask that the court require the board to follow and require the secretary to follow Jones in when they're considering cases involving the evaluation of musculoskeletal disabilities under Section 4.71A, and to reject the secretary's litigation position to carve out an exception for cases in which limitation of motion is involved. And for these reasons, and for the reasons expressed in our initial and reply briefs, we ask the court to vacate and remand the board's decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken and submitted. And at this time, we'll come down and greet counsel.